Welcome. This is the sequel, Jesus Continued in the Book of Acts, with the Reverend Dr. Alan Hilton.
Welcome to session 7 of the sequel, Jesus Continued in the Book of Acts. And tonight we're going to start with an 80s vintage Academy Award winning film, one scene from Amadeus. I don't know how many of you have seen Amadeus. It's a brilliant one. If you haven't, you really ought to. This is Tom Hulce as Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart. But the scene I'm going to talk to you about is a very funny one in which the powers that are in Vienna have decreed that there will be no dancing at the same time as there is music. This is just one of those things that rulers do when they don't have enough to occupy them. And so there's this decree that comes out. And so Mozart has to rehearse his people just dancing or just singing. And it's just ludicrous. It's just wrong, right? It just doesn't work. And so he does this in front of the powers that are. They see how ludicrous it is, and pretty soon the law disappears. But I think of this sometimes when I study Bible, oddly enough, because here's the deal. On the left is the very theological approach to the Apostle Paul by J. Christian Becker, who was one of my favorite professors at Princeton Seminary back in the day. And he moves on the history of ideas. He loves to go deep on what Paul thought about God, what Paul thought about salvation, about apocalypse, about all of those sort of theological categories. And he taught Bible that way. My Dr. Vater, the guy I studied most under at Yale after Princeton, was Wayne Meeks, who introduced really to American biblical studies social history of the New Testament, and in some ways sociology of the New Testament. And so I want you to picture the moment when I've applied for all this, you know, my graduate schools, and I didn't apply to Princeton Seminary because I'd had my good teaching from them, but also because I kind of wanted to go do what Wayne Meeks did. I wanted to do social history of the New Testament. And so the time came when I got my yes from Yale, and I went into J. Christian Becker's office, and he was brilliant, folks. I always thought as a teacher, he was better drunk and unprepared than most were sober and with time spent ahead. Dutch, been through a lot in life, Holocaust-related stuff, all those things. But I went into his office and I said, it turns out, Dr. Becker, that I've been accepted at Yale and I've accepted their offer. And he stood up just apoplectic and said, "Hilton, why do you want to go to Yale and learn how the early Christians went to the bathroom?" Right? These are the latrines in Corinth, that we're going to be in Philippi and Corinth this year. His sense was that ideas are where the real thing is, and not knowing what the archaeology was like or knowing what the culture anthropology was like. For Becker, this was an atrocity, and he was part joking. Of course, he and Wayne Meeks were friends. But we're going to take this both and out for a spin tonight, because it's possible to read Acts 16 and Acts 18, the story of Paul's sojourn in Philippi and Paul's sojourn in Corinth on his second missionary journey. It's possible to read them in very horizontal terms as a study in ancient social history and ancient cultural history and ancient psychological history in some cases. It's possible to read it as just that, or it's possible to read it as just, well, what's Paul saying about God? What's Paul saying about Jesus? How does the theology of this section work? But as we've done in most places along the way, and as we'll do more consciously tonight, I want to read first with the social history, and then paint in the theology of it. Because I think when we get both fully, we get more of the whole thing, more of each, and a more whole vision of what it was to be an early Christian and believe as an early Christian believed. So that's the method to our madness tonight. And to get there, we're going to do some reading in Philippians chapter 16. We're going to go back to a paragraph that we started with quickly last week on our way to Paul's speech in Athens in 17. We just brushed through a couple places. And so we had a paragraph that featured Lydia and Paul, but we're going to start there again because I want to go deeply into this whole section in Philippi. So let's do this. We therefore, and this will be review as I say, we therefore set sail from Troas. That's ancient Troy, by the way, interestingly. So it's just below the entry into Europe from Western Turkey. Set sail from Troas, took a straight course to Samothrace, an island. The following day to Neapolis, that's the port of Philippi, and then inland 10 miles to Philippi, which is a leading city of the district of Macedonia and a Roman colony. We remained in this city for some days. On the Sabbath day, we went outside the gate by the river where we supposed there was a place of prayer, proselche. And we sat down and spoke to the women who had gathered there. A certain woman named Lydia, a worshiper of God, was listening to us. She was from the city of Thyatira and a dealer in purple cloth. The Lord opened her heart to listen eagerly to what was said by Paul. And when she and her household were baptized, she urged us, saying, "If you've judged me to be faithful to the Lord, come and stay at my home." And she prevailed on us, as if Paul wasn't going to accept the invitation to this nice house of this dealer in the best fabric, kind of Armani of the times. She welcomes the church into her home. Let's just look at this for a second. Okay, we treated this for a moment last week because we talked about the Sibamanoi or the Theosibamanoi, who are the God-fearers or the people who hang out at the edge of the synagogue crowd and often stop short of full commitment to Judaism, but are very interested and have become monotheistic. And that's where Lydia seems to have been. Now, I will say that there were, about the time of Julius Caesar, a whole lot of Jews were moved to the region of Lydia, where she comes from, and from Thyatira, where she comes from. And so it may be that she comes from that population, because every once in a while, Sibamanoi is a Jewish devout person, but it's more likely she's one of these edge of the synagogue people. She's had a place of prayer, as we talked about last week. And after a conversation with Paul, she's baptized and invites them into her home. Now, I want to take a second with this, because a proselke can mean either, as I think it is with Lydia and these women, there had to be a quorum of 10 males for it to be a legitimate synagogue gathering, and these seem to be all females, so a place of prayer seems to have been an informal thing by the river. But a proselke could mean a synagogue, and so it's probably good for us to take a quick glimpse at one way that the Romans in these Greco-Roman times welcomed or did not welcome the Jews. Here's in Sardis. The Sardis synagogue, which is on your right there, is one of the most famous ancient synagogues. We have a lot of it. There are inscriptions from Sardis that come from the synagogue. And it's if you've not been there, it's a beautiful place to walk around. Widely known synagogue, and partly because it had images in it. And of course, Judaism at the time when it Hellenized, some of the synagogues have images in them, which we wouldn't have expected because synagogues in Palestine did not have. But here's a decree of the Sardians, the people of Sardis. Whereas those Jews who are our fellow citizens and live with us in this city have, sorry, I've got a touchy finger. Whereas these Jews who are fellow citizens and live with us in the city have ever had great benefits heaped upon them by the people and have come now into the Senate and desired of the people that upon the restitution of their law and their liberty by the Senate and people of Rome, they may assemble together according to their ancient legal custom, and that we will not bring any suit against them about it, and that a place may be given them where they may have their congregations with their wives and children, and may offer, as did their forefathers, their prayers and sacrifices to God. Now the Senate and people have decreed to permit them to assemble together on the days formerly appointed, and to act according to their own laws, and that such a place be set apart for them by the praetors, for the building and inhabiting the same, as they shall esteem fit for that purpose. And that those that take care of the provisions for the city shall take care that such sorts of food as they esteem fit for their eating may be imported into the city. This is one of the most welcoming decrees in all of the empire, but you see the reference to the general Roman approach at the time that this Sardis proclamation comes, which is from Josephus Antiquities 10, where he lists a bunch of these back to back, a bunch of these cities that are proclaiming welcome to the Jewish population in them. But you see that this is very magnanimous and very respectable of the customs of the Jews. It wasn't that way everywhere. In Philippi, we're going to see in a minute that the Jews had no such place and status. They were praying by the river. We don't know if they had a synagogue because Paul and his group are walking toward to find the prosuke, and the prosuke is going to come up in a little while, the place of prayer. That can mean a synagogue. We don't know if they had a synagogue. We do know that we'll run into some rough treatment of the Jews here in this little episode. So after Lydia's conversion, after Paul and the gang have located in her house, Paul does Philippi, as he does everywhere, and walks around the city with an eye for who might join. And one day, as we were going to the place of prayer, notice the mention again, we met a female slave who had a spirit of divination, pneuma pythone, right? And here, this language is like the Delphic Oracle, where most famous of the prophetic centers in the ancient world was the Oracle of Delphi. And this language is similar. So the art in on your left, the figure on your left is a famous image from that of a prophetess at the Delphi Oracle. But we can imagine a younger woman or girl who has the spirit of divination, and she brought her owners a great deal of money by fortune telling. So she's a slave. They are exploiting her gift, and kind of like a road show, they charge for her services. While she followed Paul and us, she would cry out, "These men are slaves of the Most High God who proclaim to you the way of salvation." And the way she's described above, the spirit that's described, would have been ecstatic. I'm not going to try to imitate it, but there may have been shrieks in the way that she presented. That would have been common. It would have been different than normal language. It wouldn't have been like a dramatic interpretation of a text. It would have been different enough that people would have known, oh, there's something spiritual going on here. And that's a thing to think about whenever you're reading about prophets in the world around Paul and the early Christians. So she's saying these things loudly, one would think, in an ecstatic form, and she kept doing it for many days. But Paul, very much annoyed, turned and said to the Spirit, "I order you in the name of Jesus Christ to come out of her." And it came out that very hour. Now, this takes us back to the ministry of Jesus, where when Jesus cast out demons, he often directly spoke to the demons. That's what Paul does here. It's what happens in a couple other places in the book of Acts. He charges the demons to come out of her, the spirit to come out of her. And he's successful. What's going to happen because of that? Well, they lose their money source. Winner owners saw that their hope of making money was gone. By the way, the spirit comes out and the prophet goes out in the way that the Greek is. There's a play on the word out or going out here. It doesn't get caught in the NRSV, but we'll just know how clever Luke is. They seized Paul and Silas and dragged them into the marketplace before the authorities. And when they brought them before the magistrates, they said, these men, these Jews, notice, are disturbing our city and are advocating customs that are not lawful for us being Romans to adopt or observe. A couple things about this. We just saw how Jews are welcomed in Sardis. And here, the thing that gets the crowd roused and turns the crowd against these apostles, this apostle and his group, is they're some of those Jews who do things we don't do as Romans. So notice the anti-Judaism or anti-Semitism that's coming out and rouse up the crowd. The crowd joined in attacking them, and the magistrates had them stripped of their clothing and ordered them to be beaten with rods. Right? So we see here that Jews don't have the place they have in Sardis and in other places like the city of Rome. The Jews here are embattled simply by being Jewish. Why is that? Well, it's a Roman colony that was originally populated by soldiers who are very loyal to the emperor, very much have been given this city as because of their service to the Roman Empire. And it seems that the Jews, however long they've been there, have never been welcome in Philippi. So all it took was saying, these guys are those Jews, and the crowd went nuts. And after the magistrates had given Paul and the guys a severe flogging, they threw him into prison. The image on the left is a Roman prison. They threw him into prison and ordered the jailer to keep them securely. Following these instructions, he put them in the innermost cell and fastened their feet in the stocks. See their feet in the stocks? About midnight, Paul and Silas were praying and singing hymns to God, and the prisoners were listening to them. Suddenly, there was an earthquake so violent that the foundations of the prison were shaken, and immediately all the doors were opened and everyone's chains were unfastened. When the jailer woke up and saw the prison doors wide open, he drew his sword and was about to kill himself, since he supposed that the prisoners had escaped. He had not done his job well, and he practically didn't want to live with the shame of it. But Paul shouted in a loud voice, "Do not harm yourself, for we're all here." Now, we didn't take time with the local magistrates, but notice how weak-kneed they were. The crowd goes nuts about these Jewish apostle, you know, this Jewish apostle and his guys, and doesn't differentiate Christianity from Judaism, by the way. The crowd goes wild because they're Jewish, and the magistrates, they realize we can make some points with the crowd, so for no good reason, we're going to flog these people. That's weak-kneed magistracy, in my view. And here we've got a jailer who is undoubtedly somehow proud of his work, who it looks like he's failed, and so he's ready to take his life. We're getting insights into the dynamics in the city of Philippi. The jailer called for lights, and rushing in, he fell down trembling before Paul and Silas. And then he brought them outside and said, "Sirs, what must I do to be saved?" Now, the word for sirs here is kurioi, lords, which we saw way back in Acts 9 when Paul says, "Who are you, kurios?" He could mean, "Who are you, sir?" or "Who are you, guy who is often who is obviously very powerful?" And we don't know which he meant. Again, here it might be sirs, or it might be these are the guys who sang and an earthquake happened. They are powerful. I'm going to call them centurion. And we don't know what she meant. It's got that ambiguity, but he definitely is leaning toward them, desiring whatever it is they have. They answered, "Believe in the Lord Jesus, and you will be saved, you and your household," as it was with Lydia. They spoke the word of the Lord to him and to all who were in his house. At the same hour of midnight of the night, he took them and washed their wounds. Then he and his entire family went to be baptized without delay. He brought them up into his house and set food before them, and his entire household rejoiced that he had become a believer in God. This is the little amphitheater where, as close as they can figure, Lydia would have been baptized from the place of prayer. If you've never been to Philippi, it's brilliant. You can get in the water, you can feel it. It's not quite deep enough where this is to fully go down as a kind of full immersion baptism, but it's a beautiful place, and it's as close as they can come to where she probably would have been baptized. It's likely that the jailer was baptized somewhere near here too, because the river goes through and there are only a few places where it works. But whatever the case about the archaeology of this, the jailer turns to them and desires what they've got, desires to be, in his words, saved. It could mean, in Greek, it means rescued, made whole, healed, or it could mean something beyond temporal life. Whatever he's asking for, Paul gives him, this is what you do to get it. Now, let's take a look at the culture a little bit. Because so far we've had a jailer who obviously has some status. He's brought Paul and his entourage into his home and fed them. Most people lived in little insulae, which were very small things, very small apartments like you would get in for not that much money in New York City, right? Just small spaces. And he lives in an honor-shame society in which people guard their name, people guard their reputation. In our society right now, people are pretty shameless about wanting to get on a video. You see a basketball game and everybody is doing stupid stuff to try to get seen. We're a little shameless. Ancient society was an honor shame culture. And we see that here, and then we see it in the very next scene where these very magistrates who have thrown Paul and the gang around and flogged them and beat them publicly get a piece of Paul's mind. When morning came, the magistrates sent the police saying, "Let those men go." They heard about the earthquake. They didn't want the ruckus. And the jailer reported the message to Paul, saying, "The magistrates sent word to let you go. Therefore, come out and go in peace." Paul replied, "They have beaten us in public, uncondemned. Men who are Romans," that is Paul and his people, "and have thrown us into prison. And now are they going to discharge us in secret?" So publicly, the magistrates have done a powerful thing and beaten these poor guys who later they find out are actually Roman citizens. And they want to release them privately. And Paul, in a way, is saying, "That's dishonoring us and trying to save a scrap of your honor, and I'm not having it." He says, "Certainly not. Let them come and take us out themselves." So you can picture the parade. The police reported these words to the magistrates. They were afraid when they heard that they were Romans, so they came and apologized to them. Now, a magistrate apologizing to a street preacher is not a usual thing, right? So this is, you get the picture in Acts of what's going on. And they took them out and asked them to leave the city. After leaving the prison, they didn't leave the city. They went to Lydia's home. And when they had seen and encouraged the brothers and sisters there, they departed. Do you see the cultural goings on here and how Paul is navigating in a place where there are a lot of pressure vectors? There are a lot of strands of social pressure and social dynamics that are pretty interesting and hard to tease out. Let's do the theology. First off, money. Do you remember way back in chapters 4 and 5? In chapter 4, you had Barnabas and his wife who gave over a piece of land to the early Christian movement and are praised about it in the end of chapter 4. In chapter 5, Ananias and Sapphira do not, they give over part of their proceeds from their land they've sold, but they lie about having given all of it over, and they are struck down on the spot. Now, it's a troubling passage for some of us, but notice the theology there, that money is a reflection of what's going on inside a person. It happens in Luke's gospel, in the parable of the rich fool. Right? He's got purple and the finest linens, or well, there's one in 12 of the rich fool, who keeps building his barns bigger, and then disaster happens and he's got nothing to take with him. In 16 of Luke, there's one in which the rich man and Lazarus live right next to each other. Lazarus is at his gate and doesn't have a house, but the rich man doesn't even notice them. So they're reversed in the afterlife. Lazarus goes to the bosom of Abraham. The rich man goes to the tongues of flame. In Luke and Acts, money is an expression of the soul. You can tell what people are theologically, spiritually, by where they put their money. I'm sure that doesn't apply now. That's supposed to be a laugh line. So if you aren't laughing, it was supposed to be irony. The upper right, of course, we get the theology of baptism. They don't delay. They go out and you see the white clothing in the early church. People would have stood on the bank in all would have been white clothing, but the baptizan would have been added, would have had white clothing after the baptism, as if putting on a new garment, and then joined with the brothers and sisters on the riverbank. And the first words out of the baptizan's mouth as she or he came out of the water would have been, "Abba, Daddy, I've got a new father, I've got a new parent, and those are my family." So baptism comes out here. She is now a sister, and the people around her in her household are brothers, Lydia and her family, because they've been baptized. The theology of baptism comes up. The power of Paul's thwarting of the spirit, the unclean spirit that the young prophetess had, is another sort of foray into the theology and this and the way it plays in the daily life that they're moving through. And then lower left, this is from IJM, International Justice Mission. This is an appeal for people to help them stop sex trafficking in around the world. And in the story of the young woman who's a slave, she's being exploited for her gift. And by the end of the story, Luke doesn't follow her story, but one thinks that it probably got better once she was freed from those guys than it was when they were telling her everything to do. So we've got justice with money, we've got family and baptism, we've got power in spirit, and we've got justice in terms of an enslaved woman. Those are all theological things that happen along the way as the anthropological and sociological things that we've all been observing as we've gone through also happen. So the mingling of both of them has a power to it. Let's move then from that to Acts 18 and the Corinthians. This one is shorter. What you see on your screen, by the way, is what an ancient tent covering might have looked like. I've always pictured Paul making tents, and here we're going to be introduced to Paul's friends, Priscilla and Aquila, pardon me, who also are tent makers. They meet each other in the guild. But this is a brilliant color, and I had always, kind of pictured military tents or kind of gray, drab things. But this very well might have been what Paul and Priscilla and Aquila were making for a living. In his letter to the Corinthians, Paul will say, I worked hard among you to pay my own rent, so to speak. And this is what he was doing. But let's read as Acts has it in 18:1. After this, that is after the talk with the Epicureans and Stoics on Mars Hill and all that happened in Athens, Paul left Athens and went to Corinth. It's about 45 miles, about an hour's drive west of Athens. There he found a Jew named Aquila from Pontus, who had recently come from Italy along with his wife Priscilla, because Claudius had ordered all Jews to leave Rome. Claudius is the emperor of Rome at the time. Paul went to see them, and because he was of the same trade, he stayed with them, and they worked together. By trade, they were tent makers. Every Sabbath, Paul would argue in the synagogue and would try to convince Jews and Greeks. Now, I want to notice a couple things as we do this. One is Claudius's edict that expelled Jews for a time from the city of Rome. And we're going to get to that in a moment. The other is Priscilla and Aquila don't get baptized here. Why is that? Well, Christianity got to Rome before it got to Corinth, apparently. We know that there was an existing, in fact, a sort of thriving church in Rome by the time Paul wrote his letter to Rome, never having been there. And so it's likely that Christianity followed the trade route to Rome and preceded even Paul's mission in Corinth, because now Priscilla and Aquila have come and may already be Christians when Paul meets them. That's an interesting thing to think. The early Christians were very mobile, and so they've come from Rome to flee the edict, you know, according to the edict. They've landed in Corinth. Paul meets them there, and they end up fast friends and missionary partners. Okay, third thing to notice. Paul was in the habit, in Acts, he's in the habit of arguing the synagogue before he heads off to hit the rest of the city. Now, here's where we find out about Claudius's edict. This is in a historian called Suetonius. His work is called Divus Claudius, the divine Claudius, the emperor. And it simply says, since the Jews constantly made disturbances at the instigation of Crestus, he, the emperor Claudius, expelled them from Rome. So why did Claudius throw the Jews out of Rome? Well, he saw this group that was making a ruckus about a certain Crestus, which seems to me to mean, and has seemed to interpreters for a long time to mean, that Christians who look like Jews and Jews who look like Jews got into a little bit of a fracas in Rome, and the emperor had had enough of it and sent them all out. So the earlier speculation that these two are Christians already before they come has a pretty good chance of being true, that Priscilla and Aquila were Christians when Paul met them. Nice bust of Claudius in his younger days. When Silas and Timothy arrived from Macedonia, Paul was occupied with proclaiming the word, testifying to the Jews that Messiah was Jesus. When they opposed and reviled him in protest, he shook the dust from his clothes and said to them, your blood be on your own heads. I'm innocent. From now on, I'll go to the Gentiles. Has anybody heard that before in Acts? Yeah, it's kind of become a theme in Acts, so much so that some scholars, as we've noticed along the way, believe that wherever it was, Luke's formula was to have Paul go in, whether he had sources who told him this or not. It's almost like he couldn't introduce easily Paul into a city without having him go to the synagogue and get rejected. We talked about it last week as sort of a concept of supersessionism, that Christianity was bound to try itself out on the Jews in any city, and then when they reject, go separate instead of staying within the Jewish community. All right. So then he left the synagogue and went to the house of a man named Titius Justus, a worshiper of God. His house was next door to the synagogue. You'll notice in this chapter in Acts, in Acts chapter 18, we get more names in Corinth than we get anywhere else. Names are kind of hard to come by. We had Lydia in Philippi. We get Jason in Thessalonica between them. But we don't get a plethora of local names. The Rolodex that we would get from Acts is not that thick. The contact list in our apps would not be that thick. But Corinth has a lot of the ones we know. And so let's take a look. First off, this is a marker from the synagogue in Corinth. And you can kind of see these are menorahs that are on this carved into this stone. And so archaeologists found these in Corinth and tried to place them where they think they would be, you know, amid the ruins in Corinth and the reconstructions in Corinth. And so that is an indicator that when Luke says there's synagogue in Corinth, he's not lying. But now see what happens, because we run into a guy who is the official of the synagogue. Crispus, the official of the synagogue, reminds me of Jairus back in the Gospels. Crispus became a believer in the Lord, together with his whole household. And many of the Corinthians who heard Paul became believers and were baptized. So among the Jewish people, Paul made more inroads than he sometimes did in his startup with synagogue time. One night, the Lord said to Paul in a vision, "Do not be afraid, but speak and do not be silent. For I am with you, and no one will lay a hand on you to harm you, for there are many in this city who are my people." Remember the man from Macedonia who told Paul, "Come on over to Macedonia," in a vision when he was in Turkey. Here we have another visitation of God to embolden Paul in his ministry. He stayed there a year and 6 months, 18 months in Corinth. It's the longest that we see him stay except in Ephesus. So we go on to the next paragraph. When Gallio was proconsul of Achaia, which is the area in which Corinth is a region, the Jews made a united attack on Paul and brought him before the tribunal. They said, "This man is persuading people to worship God in ways that are contrary to the law." We don't know whether they meant Torah or Roman law. They just say the law. Let's see how it plays out. Just as Paul was about to speak, Gallio said to the Jews, "If it were a matter of crime or serious villainy, I'd be justified in accepting the complaint of you Jews. But since it's a matter of questions about words and names and your own law, see to it yourselves. I do not wish to be a judge of these matters." And he dismissed them from the tribunal. And then all of them seized Sosthenes, the official of the synagogue, and beat him in front of the tribunal. But Gallio paid no attention to any of these things. Notice what's happened here. Remember in Philippi just minutes ago, remember that the Christian missionaries, these Christian preachers, Paul and his entourage, are grouped together in public perception with the Jews. All of them are in one bucket. There's no differentiation between, quote, Christian and Jew. So the crowd gets riled up in Philippi because somebody said these Jews are carrying on. And they were talking about Paul and the people, right? Paul and his entourage. Here we have the Jews in Corinth trying to separate the two, trying to make it clear to Gallio, these guys aren't us. These guys are doing something else than our good synagogue. But Gallio will have nothing of it. He just blots it all together and says, this is up to you all to solve. It's not Roman law that's being violated. It's up to you. It's a religious internal matter. which is kind of the way the Romans handled things. If you didn't get out of hand, it didn't matter that much to them. So he dismissed them from the tribunal, and then they beat up on Sosthenes for a bit, and the episode ends. It happens that there's an inscription in Corinth. It's not written beautifully. It's not a high-level pro who wrote it. But in that middle piece, in the third line down, maybe fourth if you include the little two-letter thing at the top, is the name Gallio. You can see a Greek gamma, which is the fifth letter in from the left. And then it's an alpha, and then a couple lambdas, and then a yoda, and then an omega. Gallio, right in the middle there. And it happens that it dates him in 51 CE. Claudius's edict happened in 49 CE. So we're getting some traction on knowing when this second missionary journey of Paul happened. It's sometime around, I mean, at least he reaches Corinth around 50, 51, which puts him in Thessalonica in 49 or 50, and Philippi in 49 or 50. That's the only way we know where to place this on a timeline. This little inscription helps us, and Claudius's edict helps us. But Claudius's is a little wider, so this really helps us to know when Paul writes Thessalonians, his first letter, he writes it from Athens, and he writes it back to the Christians north in Thessalonica. And we know it happened in 49 or 50 because that's when Claudius's edict happened, and that's when all of this action happened. All right, let's close, because I don't know if you noticed, but there's been this incompleteness in your soul, because we did Philippi horizontally. We did Philippi on the social and anthropological and sociological and psychological level. And then we did theological insights from Philippi. Now we've done Corinth at a horizontal and psychological and sociological and culture, all those. But we better get back to theology in chapter 18. And so Paul has fellowship with Priscilla and Aquila. He finds people who do what he does, and it will persist. He'll name them when he writes to Rome. They'll get named in Ephesus. They just become his people. His maybe some of his closest allies in Christianity, and certainly co-workers with Paul. And I may be projecting here. For the last 8 years, I've been flying everywhere, and doing church by church by church on kind of a Pauline model. And there can be a little loneliness involved. So what I read here is the theology of fellowship enters when he gets to meet people who do what he does, and think in some ways about Christ and about mission in the way that he does. And that's a theological reality that's behind they do the same job. The second is when Paul gets that visitation of God, sort of like the man from Macedonia, but this is just reassurance. Don't be afraid, God. Or God says to Paul, don't be afraid, because there are many people in the city. You've encountered early opposition, and you will get that. But I have many people in this city. And he goes back somewhat bolstered and reassured. And then they raise a ruckus again. And then, right, 18 months he stayed in Corinth. That's a big deal. And it is instantiated in that reassurance from God. And then the third is, in both of these places, we get to visit the interplay of church and state. And in both cases, there is persecution that is either instigated by the state, a flogging in Corinth or in Philippi, or resisted by the state, even though there's a mob in the streets. And so we've got different responses from two different governors, basically, or magistrates. The Christians would have to grapple with the theology of living in an empire. And so in Romans 13, Paul will address that in one way, saying The authorities are put there by God. And so you all probably know at some level passage in Romans 13, or it'll go the way John does in Revelation and have Babylon the Great, which is Rome, thrown into the lake of fire. And there will be different Christian reactions theologically to how state and church interact. There are different theological interpretations of church and state on this screen tonight. And that's a good thing. We can kind of learn from each other. We can kind of temper each other if we talk about things like that and listen about things like that. But there is difference. And there, it's one of the things that often divides Christians in the United States and around the world. How do we respond to the powers that be? Where do we sit in a democracy or wherever we are situated in the world? And so we're coming down the stretch here. And I want to get back and just reiterate, I am so glad that I sat with both J. Christian Becker and Wayne Meeks, that those things merged in the way that Bible came alive for me. And I highly recommend it. I highly recommend finding your way into what does it feel like to be one of the Christians in one of these churches, and where did I go to work, and how much money do I make? Where am I in society if I'm an early Christian? And actually stand in their shoes, because insights from the way daily life would have gone, that's Meeksian, matter for the way the theology lands and the way the different perspectives that come from different social classes and different places in society matter for the way theology forms in us. It's part of why we stay together. It's part of why it helps to have difference in the house, is we work hard to understand one another, helps us to work hard to understand God. And the other reason is opera's better with music and dancing.
Thank you for joining us. Please join us next week for Session 8.